Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for Women Over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi, and welcome. Today I'll be talking with two domestic violence survivors passionate about the topic and providing help to all victims. Kit Gruel is a survivor of domestic violence who has worked as an advocate for battered women and their children for more than 30 years. As a renowned community educator, she has empowered scores of advocates, criminal justice professionals, healthcare providers, clergy, legislators, educators, and other allied professionals to prevent family and domestic abuse. She is the subject of Private Violence, an intimate and compelling documentary on domestic violence, which premiered at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival and will run on HBO beginning in October of this year. Lindsay Fisher is a trauma-tested author who writes about her own experiences to help others feel less alone. A former English teacher and dance coach, a domestic violence survivor, she refuses to be silent about the things that change our lives. For her, those issues are domestic violence and infertility. Her memoir, The House on Sunset, is an Amazon bestseller and is currently a nonfiction semifinalist in the Kindle Book Awards. She can be found at the Good Men Project, Sweatpants and Coffee, and XO Jane. So welcome, Kit and Lindsay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Let's start, Lindsay, with the stats you provide in your great book, The House on Sunset. Can you tell me a little bit more about those stats and just read them to me quickly?
You know what? I don't actually have the book right in front of me to do that.
Okay.
But I can tell you that the reason that I put them there is I think that a lot of people don't realize how prevalent this epidemic is in our society. And so by putting those statistics right out front, I think that a lot of people can, you know, maybe see it as a more tangible issue. One of the ones that kind of sticks out to me more than anything and one that's commonly used is one in four women will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. And I think, you know, if you look at that number and 25% of our society and women, you know, dealing with what we have survived is an incredible and devastating number.
So let's start with you, Kit. I found all of the statistics, all of the readings, fairly mind-blowing, and I'm wondering, what is this phenomenon? What is going on here?
Well, I think the term domestic violence is a term that allows people to kind of switch things off. For one thing, it happens behind closed doors, and so oftentimes people are unaware of just exactly how extreme and complex violence in the home is because it remains invisible. I mean, I know that if we didn't have the tape of Ray Rice punching his then fiance, there wouldn't have been the outcry that there was. And so I think that part of what we have to do is we have to recognize that we do in fact have an epidemic. That what's at the core of that epidemic is the need for the abuser to gain and maintain power and control over his partner, primarily his. It's still victims of domestic violence are still primarily women, and that one of the things that I think we oftentimes fail to recognize is how society sort of plays a role in supporting violence against women. Whether it's through, you know, commercials or, you know, any form of entertainment. When we use women, violence against women as a form of entertainment, then we're basically saying to abusers, we agree with you. We think this is fine. And another thing that I think we have a problem with is we don't connect the dots between what happens behind closed doors in the name of love, in the name of family, and then how that winds up spilling out onto the streets. So if we were to address holistically gender-based violence and say to abusers, no, this is unacceptable, and you are not entitled to control, abuse, harass, intimidate, coerce your wife or girlfriend just by virtue of the fact that you happen to be a male, then we would have, it's actually liberating for men. And we would also have children growing up in homes where, rather than being afraid to walk in the door, you know, they'd grow up to be fully functioning children. And I wish that we would, as a society, really take a harder look at what domestic violence costs us, not just in dollars, but in, you know, in how people's lives are affected. So sorry it was a long answer, but it's a great big question.
It's just all powerful. I mean, everything you're saying is just resonating. Before we get into the definition of domestic violence, you just made a point about the cameras capturing Ray Rice. And I guess the other question would be, given that we have so many forms now of photography, whether it be our cell phone or our security camera, I would guess that more and more incidents are being captured and brought to light. Is that correct?
Well, I know that that women and children are in fact capturing what's happening. And then another thing that's really important is 911 calls, because the 911 calls unfortunately really lay bare what the chaos sounds like and what the abuse sounds like. But in the same way that people have used their cell phones to capture violence in the streets, whether it's through Black Lives Matter or other types of violence, the same kind of thing can happen with domestic violence cases, but of course they present a unique set of very dangerous circumstances, because if the abuser realizes that she has been taping him, then that can really enhance the danger for her. So when we talk to women about capturing what's happening through video or through audio, we encourage them to, you know, send it to their attorney or send it to a friend or something like that, because if they keep it on their phone and he finds it, then that can make things much, much more dangerous for her.
So let's set the groundwork for the listener. What is the definition of domestic violence? What are some of the reasons why it's caused? Does it span all races, religions? And is there a difference between domestic violence perpetrated by men and women? Who'd like to start with that?
Go ahead.
I can start. I think, you know, the definition of domestic violence through history has just progressively sort of encapsulated what's actually happening. And I think as I progress through answering the rest of your questions, the definition is actually going to become a little bit clearer. So I will start by saying that, yes, it is all-encompassing. There, you know, domestic violence does not discriminate against any particular, at least in my experience and the work that I have done, group more than another. So, you know, with my example being, I'm a college-educated professional woman who happened to have an abuser who owned a multi-million-dollar company. And if you look at it just from that alone, you know, most people don't assume that that type of person, if you will, you know, with that socioeconomic background, would be involved in domestic violence. And, you know, part of the reason that I think it was easy for me to sort of overlook the red flags is because I never assumed, and that was ignorant on my part, that I would be included in, you know, this statistic. I never thought that I would be in sort of this sisterhood, if you will. I have never seen a certain person be safe from it, and that is, you know, something that society definitely needs to be aware of, as, you know, when we talk about these topics, because a lot of times what happens is people are very afraid that they could be victimized in this way. And so instead of dealing with that fear and helping prevent, you know, future violence, what we do is we say, well, I would never be in that situation. And we close ourselves off to it. You know, that doesn't help you prepare for when and if that could actually be your situation down the line. And it certainly doesn't help society prevent this from becoming an even bigger problem than what it already is.
Well, and I'd like to add to it, too, is that by using the term domestic violence, unfortunately what we do is we raise the bar up so that society fails to respond to her until she's got black eyes and broken noses.
Yes.
And one of the things that I think we have to do is we have to start to focus at the earlier controlling tactics like coercion and intimidation and manipulation, so that she can see the warning signs before it gets to the point that he's using physical violence to control her, because that's what it's all about. And what I refer to domestic to physical violence as a punctuation mark to all the other tactics that he uses. And, you know, those, that's, again, coercion, manipulation, using the children, all sorts of things. And I think we have to remind ourselves that what usually happens after there's been a domestic violence murder-suicide, and the TV station comes out with a reporter, and the reporter finds the neighbor, and the neighbor gets interviewed, and what the neighbor typically says is, but he seemed like such a nice guy. And so what that should tell us is that if he chooses to be a nice guy when he walks out the door, that's a form of manipulation. That's a way for him to get all the neighbors and police and everybody else on board thinking that he's this great guy. Then that also means that he's making a choice to be controlling and aggressive and abusive when he walks in the door. So society likes to think that abusers are out of control, and the exact opposite is true. They're not out of control at all. They're exercising absolute, complete, and intense control because they're choosing when and with whom to be abusive, controlling, and violent with.
Is there a difference between domestic violence perpetrated between men and women?
Well, you have to kind of look at what the desired outcome is, and this is a generalization. So there are females who are the abusers in the relationship, but by and large, what the research has shown over and over again is that when women choose to be abusive, they're oftentimes being abusive because they feel like the system has failed them. They feel like they're having to protect themselves or their children, and so they're having to take matters into their own hands. For men who are abusive, they're abusive because they feel entitled to be. They feel that their wife or girlfriend is their private property to do with as they please. And so the abuse, the goal for them is to make sure that she continues to perform, and I'm putting perform in air quotes, perform in the ways in which he feels she should be performing. And he will use any or a dozen different tactics to make sure that she continues to do what he expects her to do. So rather than just looking at it as apples and oranges, we have to understand and examine what the desired outcome of the abuse or the violence is.
Does an increase in this ever reflect economic factors, political factors, sociological factors? Is there ever any external reason why the numbers of incidents would increase or decrease?
I think that when you look at any system that is rigid in its construction, that is about securing a degree of power for a group of people based on gender, based on class, based on this, based on that. I mean, we still live in a very patriarchal society. Our laws are written, you know, primarily by men, and the laws and the ways in which those laws get played out and get enforced oftentimes are up to men. And so if we have people writing laws and enforcing laws that are blind to the power that they have personally based on the fact that they're men, and then when you layer on top of that a political belief system and a religious belief system, you can see how or what the final outcome might be. And in the 30 years that I've done this work, there are some things that have changed, but there are also some things that unfortunately have not changed. And I think religion, politics, and class has a lot to do with it.
So, Lindsay, what would compel someone to stay as opposed to go? And if they choose to go, where would they go?
Well, those are both really good questions. And I think, you know, part of the reason that a lot of people stay, and before I give my experience, what I would like to say about that is that there are a million reasons why people stay. Ultimately, each survivor that you could ever talk to would probably give you a different response right off the bat. What I believe makes people stay is that, you know, they may feel more safe. There may be some sort of financial abuse that's happening that they don't have the money to leave. There are a million reasons why someone might not leave. Ultimately, in my situation, the reason that I didn't leave is because I genuinely felt, up until the very last day, that I was safer with him than I would be if I tried to walk out the door, because I was convinced that he was going to try to kill me. So I, you know, until that moment happened in my life, where I realized that he would inevitably attempt to kill me, either whether or not I was in the house or not. I thought that being in that home was going to be safer. So, you know, but through my work doing domestic violence chat on Twitter, and just sort of having these conversations with multiple survivors who are out and speaking, I will tell you that, you know, staying is, it's so dangerous when you try to leave. And if you look at the statistics, that's one of the most dangerous times for women who are trying to leave an abuser, because the likelihood of them being severely injured or murdered is significantly higher than if, you know, when they're in that relationship. What was the second part of that question?
Where can they go if they choose? And I do want to ask you, how did you leave? Did you just walk out the door?
I ended up, you know, and I would never, ever recommend to any person in an abusive relationship doing what I did, because ultimately you have to think about your safety, and there are plenty of places now that I know of that can help you come up with a safety plan and sort of create that process for you to help you navigate it in a much safer way. The day that I left, he attacked me, and I basically said to him, you know, if this is what you want, then, you know, let's do it. I'm done, because I felt worthless, and I was ready for him to end whatever was going to happen that day. And so I think just in sort of calling him out, there was a moment of shock. He did not expect that from me, and he actually, you know, told me I had an hour before he would come home. He said, I'm leaving. You have an hour to get your belongings out of this house, and then after that, you know, you're going to deal with me again. And if you want to talk about power and control, you know, that's exactly what he was trying to sort of show in those moments. From there, I was fortunate enough to actually have my own home to go back to, but because of, you know, financial abuse and a lot of other things, I had abandoned it. So I did not have electricity, I did not have water, and I did not have money to get those amenities turned back on. What happens a lot of times, and again, another reason why people stay, is because they don't have a place to go. They don't see a way out because they have been alienated from their family, from their friends, or they don't have the financial stability to go get their own apartment. There are shelters available for women to go into, but a lot of times they are full, or they are not, you know, close enough for somebody to even know about it. And to be totally transparent, at that point in my life, had I not had my own home to go to when I was leaving, I would have had no idea where to go, because I did not know that shelters were around. I did not know that nonprofits existed. And my friends and family were so far alienated because I was so ashamed and embarrassed of what was happening that I was unable to sort of keep them close enough to let them watch it. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, finding a place to go when you're ready to leave is a problem. There are a lot of resources available online. There's a website called domesticshelters.org where you can go and put your zip code into their website, and it will pull all of the domestic violence nonprofits that exist in, like, order of how close they are to your zip code, which is an amazing resource for people to use and one that I recommend. And then, you know, the National Domestic Violence Hotline is also another place where people can get a hold of some of these resources that they may not know exist.
Do you feel like
there's another part of this that we need to talk about, and that is, why should women have to leave when they haven't done anything wrong? And we've been building shelters for 35, 40 years now, and while I know that shelters are really, really, really important places, and women can go there and meet other women, and they can get themselves stabilized and help their kids and all that sort of thing, I also think that on some level it's sending the wrong message. And the message we should be sending to abusers is, you can't do this anymore. And there should be sanctions. There should be community-based sanctions, whether it's, abuser treatment programs, whether it's jail, whether it's whatever. I mean, you know, there's a program in Tel Aviv, Israel, called Bet Noam. And they looked at the lay of the land over in Tel Aviv about 15 years ago, and they said, well, why are we telling women and children who have been abused that they now have to pack up and leave behind schools, family, friends, pets, jobs, the whole nine yards, and go into this place and hide when they haven't done anything wrong? And so what they did in Tel Aviv was they opened up a facility to send abusers to. And one of the main things that they wanted to do was make sure that women and children could remain in their natural environment, and that the community was going to say to domestic abusers, we are going to give you an opportunity to change the way you relate to your family, and we're going to hold you accountable. And I know that gets bandied around a whole lot, but in this case, in Tel Aviv, they really did it. And I think if we kind of flip the coin a little bit, and rather than saying to women, why didn't you just leave, instead look at him and say, what makes you think that you've got the right to coerce, control, and intimidate your wife and kids? You don't have that right, and we as a community are going to stand against it. It's interesting because we don't do it with any other kind of crime. We don't say to a bank president whose bank has been robbed 5, 6, 7 times, why are you still doing business here? You need to move this bank. You need to close this bank up. Do you like someone showing up with a gun and robbing this place? What's the matter with you? So there's something still unique in this country where when a woman is either physically or sexually assaulted, the very first thing we do is society looks at her and says, what'd you do to make him mad? Why were you wearing those clothes? And every time we do that, we're essentially driving the getaway car for the abuser. And I think that's one of the things we need to focus on.
What laws, in a generic sense, protect the victims and the survivors, and what laws actually protect the abusers? And then the second question would be, why is there a difference in regions or in states across the country?
Well, I've been in Utah since January, so I'm not as familiar with Utah law quite yet, but I can tell you about North Carolina law. In North Carolina, there's a charge called misdemeanor assault with a deadly weapon. So in North Carolina, a man can shoot or stab his wife or girlfriend unless it involves injury to a major organ. It's probably going to get charged at the misdemeanor level, and I think that's pretty consistent across the country. So when women can be that badly assaulted and it still be charged as a misdemeanor, the court is an echo chamber. And when a woman has that experience and she goes into court and she knows how badly she's been hurt, and yet the court still labels this assault a misdemeanor, it sends a message not only to her but to everybody else. Don't even bother. There's no point. And, I'm from the South where, where beating women is still in many communities just the way it goes. And so, yes, there's a regional component to it. There's a religious component to it. And we just have to start to value the lives of women and children and have laws that accurately reflect that. And currently, we don't have that.
I agree completely. And I think even in the Midwest, I'm in Missouri, and, they are actually attempting to, on January 1, change the law to where there is a felony charge related to domestic violence, not that there wasn't before, but an additional one. What we're looking at, however, is even in talking to the prosecuting attorney in my county, that they don't believe that that will actually be used. So we can change the law, but it doesn't mean that they're getting the charges that they want against these people because of the way that the system is set up as a whole.
Can I get a very brief, basic profile of an abuser? Can a person abuse once and never again? I know that we said that they span all race, religion, genders, and creeds, but have they been abused and therefore they're re-abusing? Lindsay?
Abusers are very interesting. There's a really good book on this by a man named Lundy Bancroft, and it's called Why Does He Do That? And this man basically worked as a therapist rehabilitating abusers for lots and lots of years, and ultimately what he found in his research and doing that work is that most of them cannot be rehabilitated because they don't want to be rehabilitated. So they are, again, like Kit said earlier, making that choice. This is the sort of lifestyle that they believe they should have. He, through his work, said 98% of men who are abusive are probably going to abuse again. And the 2% that came to him that he actually believed he could help or that chose to walk in and were not legally mandated to be there, ultimately some of the similarities that they did have were that they had witnessed abuse as children, so they were secondary survivors. Maybe their parent, their father was abusive to their mother. And so they just thought that that was what was normal and healthy, and through going through this have realized that that's a problem and they would like to change it. But ultimately what we're most of the time looking at is somebody who is going to consistently display the same sort of dangerous behavior as they progress through all of their relationships. If there is one thing that I can say, or especially like reemphasize through this conversation, it's that the only similarity for me in, you know, the way to sort of identify an abuser is to look at how they are using manipulation to gain power and control over whoever they are with at that point. That is the key here, is that it is all about manipulation, manipulating them into believing, you know, that this person has control over them. And that is the one key for me, I think, that they all sort of carry.
Well, and another thing, too, is that we hold out this image of what strong men are supposed to be, and they find their strength through feeling superior to other people. I was just in Duluth, Minnesota, a couple weeks ago, and I had the privilege of listening to some men who have been through their offender treatment program. And these men, you know, realized that their families were afraid of them. They didn't love them. They were afraid of them. Every time they'd walk in the door, their families would scatter and go to their bedrooms. And since they've been through the program, they realize now that there's an enormous difference between love and respect. And what they want in their lives is love. They want their families to feel safe with them. They want them to come to them, not to run in the opposite direction when they come home. And so I think what men have to start to understand is what they're losing as they seek that kind of power, because they're certainly not loved. They're just feared. And as the guys in Minnesota said, fear and respect are not the same thing.
We have only about 1 minute left, so I'm just curious, how do you not stay perpetually angry about this state of affairs? Kit?
Because I've seen survivors, and I've seen men change how they interact with their families, and so yes, I get depressed, and yes, I get upset, and I hear people say, "Well, why doesn't she just leave?" And it's not about whether she does or doesn't leave; it's about the choice that he makes to be abusive and aggressive and violent. But I've had the privilege over all these years of working with women who have transcended this kind of life and done amazing things with their lives, like what Lindsay's done, and. So for me, that's, you know, there's a huge storm cloud. I'm not pretending there's not, but there's also this fabulous, wonderful silver lining, and it's the silver lining that keeps me going.
Lindsay, very quickly.
It's the exact same thing. It's knowing that, you know, I would never choose to go through what I did, but having gone through it, I've made the choice to make my life better afterwards, and in doing that, I'm helping better other people's lives, and that is the silver lining of all of this that keeps me going. And self-care. I take care of myself every day. I work hard at making sure that I am doing things for myself so that I don't have, you know, sort of, I'm not re-triggered.
One last question for both of you. What is the easiest way that each of you reaches out to other women to help them very quickly?
Well, for me, it's to help them understand that this is not their fault and that they shouldn't feel ashamed. That there's a community for them, and they deserve to be plugged into that community and to get the respect and the care and the consideration and the support that they deserve.
Lindsay?
I'm just going to say yes to everything that Kit just said. Yes, yes, yes.
We've just spent a fascinating half hour discussing domestic violence, women survivors passionate about helping others along the way. Lindsay Fisher can be found at www.survivorswillbeheard.com. Private Violence, the film, will begin airing on HBO this fall. I really want to thank you. We just started, and I could have spoken so much longer on this. Thank you so much, Lindsay and Kit, for being my guests.
Thank you. One quick thing I want to say is that the film has already premiered on HBO. It premiered in October of 2014, but it's still in circle on HBO Go.
Thank you. I just saw that, too. Thank you so much. I'm Sima Shapiro. I want to thank you to the listener for joining us today. And until next time, I hope you take care.